Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're going to talk today about the minimum wage. There's a lot of discussion. Is it good for the economy, bad for the economy? Will it lift workers' salaries up? What's the net impact of all this? And particularly for us, what's the impact on the creation of jobs? Because in the end, we are net in favor of more job creation here on this show. We're not a political organization here. As you can tell, we don't do politics. But periodically, we do economics. And we love to tell the story of business owners because their stories are rarely told. And my goodness, the people who run businesses, they're the lifeblood of this economy. They're the ones who create the jobs. They're the ones who create everything. Without them, this is not a country. And so we came across an article in National Review about minimum wage. And joining us is Jamie Richardson, a vice president at White Castle. And for those of you not lucky enough to have a White Castle in your state, I grew up in New Jersey and I couldn't live without them. And they're in your freezer aisle at most supermarkets in this country in all 50 states. And Jamie, thanks for joining us. And joining us also is Jahangir Kabir, a district supervisor at White Castle. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you. And hey, Lee, with that shout out, you might be on the path to the Cravers Hall of Fame. Yeah, that's some enthusiasm from a New Jersey day. So thank you. We appreciate it.
Oh, there's nothing like a White Castle. And especially when you're just, I like them at around, my favorite time for a White Castle, around 8 or 9 p.m. And I can down, in my prime, I could down 12 of them. Which I'm very proud of. And folks, if you haven't had them, they're small burgers, but they're delightful burgers. This is sounding like an advertisement, Jamie, so let's go on to the issue. So I wanted to start.
We appreciate it.
Oh, you bet. I want to start, Jahangir, with you first. You know, a lot of folks that I know don't like calling these minimum wage jobs. They like calling them entry-level jobs. I want to talk about the importance of the entry-level job you had at White Castle in your life. Tell us, Jahangir, your story.
Well, first of all, thank you so much to give me the opportunity to come up and talk about my story. I greatly, greatly appreciate this, Lee Habib. You know, I came in this country in 1990 from Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a very poor country, and I came in this country, first of all, I was in culture shock. I had no clue what was going on here. And second of all, the problem was I didn't speak any English. So, you know, I started looking at a job. Nobody would hire me. You know, so it was a very, very bad situation in my life. So, you know, all of a sudden I walked into a White Castle restaurant in Elmhurst, Queens, New York. And I had this conversation with this gentleman named Eugene Miller. And I sort of communicated my situation with him with broken language. One word here, one word there. And luckily my sister-in-law was here with me. And she was able to help me express myself, what my situation is. And Mr. Miller was very kind. He actually offered me a job on the spot. He said, hey, listen, you can come and join our team. You really don't need English to cook hamburgers. That's what my sister-in-law told me in my own language. You are more than welcome to join. And I was able to join that location. If White Castle was not there, I probably wouldn't be here today.
And Jahangir. And Jahangir, you started at that job cooking hamburgers, and that was 1990. Where are you today? What has White Castle meant to you and that entry-level job meant to you?
Well, let me tell you what happened. I had a desire to learn and learn English. So once I learned really English good, I was able to move up within the company. I became an instructor. I became a crew manager. I became a general manager. Right now, I'm a district manager running 8 locations in New York City. About $14 million in business. I hope Jamie's okay. I'm giving out some numbers. That's the only number I'm giving out just about. I have about 250 employees works for me. You know, not only that, I think the most important part is that I had an opportunity to work at White Castle. I at the same time attend school. So I'm very happy to report to your audience that I was able to finish my Doctor of Business Administration degree this February. So that's what White Castle means to an individual like me. That's what White Castle or restaurant industry means to someone like me. And that's my story. That's my experience. And thank you so much for making the opportunity available to speak about it.
Well, Jahangir, these stories are really important. And for the life of me, I've always wondered why American business doesn't just get a channel and just pipe these stories out because they're true to the rest of the American people. And then we could have an honest gut discussion about minimum wage and all the implications of raising it to $15. Jamie, tell us what Jahangir's story means for you as it relates to the minimum wage, because this is personal, isn't it?
It's really personal, and we're so proud of Jahangir, and we're so proud to call him our colleague and friend, Dr. Jahangir Kabir. You know, as a family-owned business that's been around for 95 years, we've been in the city of New York since 1930, and all along the way, one of the things we've been able to do is provide more opportunity for more people, and Jahangir's story to us is why we exist. It's not just about selling hot and tasty food that's fun and that's good and that's important. It's about the opportunity we provide to great people who get to have their dreams come true because they've joined us. And to us, that's why we exist. And so when we hear things about government officials thinking this is a good idea, on paper it might feel that way. The reality is when you foist that upon business and you try to come in with an edict that says it has to be at this level by this day, you prevent that business from being able to hire more people. So it's actually the antithesis of why we exist. It works against that.
Well, hold on that with that thought. We're going to come back on the other side and dig into the actual policy implications. We're talking to Jamie Richardson, Vice President of White Castle and a member of the Job Creators Network, and Jahangir Kabir, a district supervisor at White Castle. And this is an important discussion, folks, and you're going to get another side of this story that you might not get in other places. And again, we don't do politics here on Our American Stories. But my goodness, that immigrant story you just heard from Jahangir, there's millions of stories like that, folks, in this great country. More with Our American Stories after these messages. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. The minimum wage, that's what we're talking about. But we're talking about it where the rubber hits the road. We're talking about it with a company called White Castle. If you live in the Northeast, you know what we're talking about. If you don't, oh, I'm so sorry. But you can go to the supermarket and grab some White Castle burgers in the aisle, and later we'll give you some cooking instructions so you can know just what we're actually experiencing in places like New York and New Jersey. Alex?
Don't forget about the Midwest, Lee. We had it here in Chicago. My grandma actually used to sneak White Castle burgers when we would go in the movie theater. You're not allowed to bring in outside food, but we'd always bring in that White Castle.
Well, that's we'll get more into the details about the joys of White Castle, but we're here to talk about the minimum wage and for restaurants, for so many businesses in this country, and by the way, franchise businesses too, and there are 20% of all American businesses are franchises. This minimum wage issue is personal. So, Jamie, get into the nuts and bolts here for our audience. Well, you know, when I hear young people, particularly, we broadcast here from Oxford, Mississippi. There are lovely kids here, and they're all walking around talking about $15 and a fair wage. You know what I always say to them? Why not $50 as a minimum wage? Let's make it $50 an hour. And they don't. They think I'm kidding, but I ask a serious question when I ask that. Talk about that $15 and what it means to you and how it could actually harm job creation, something you intimated earlier.
Great questions. And first, let me share what we're for. We're absolutely in favor of providing more employment to more people at great wages. And we provide great benefits as a family-owned business. That's been part of our business model right from the very beginning, because we understand it's the dignity of each person. And our founder's philosophy was happy employees make happy customers. So that's the heart and soul of who we are at White Castle. I mean, we provide a great wage, but in addition to that, we have a retirement benefit, a healthcare benefit. What a mandated starting pay rate of $15 means for us in the state of New York, where it's just been actually passed, is catastrophic. The reason it's catastrophic is it takes the wage rate and drives it up so high so fast, there's no way for us to be able to continue to make money that we can reinvest in the business, reinvest in our people, to be able to achieve the things we want to in each of our neighborhoods. So let me give you the breakdown on the numbers. So when you take that wage rate, that starting wage rate up 50%, that represents about 30% of our total cost in a restaurant, what we invest in our hourly wages. So it's almost a third of our total cost is in that wage rate. So when you crank it up 50% or more, somehow, some way, we have to find a way to try to get that back. One thing is to look at trying to raise prices. But we also know people have choices. They don't have to go to White Castle. They can make leftovers last longer at home.
Yep.
So that's one thing that's reality. The other factor is, candidly, you try to manage your hours then to be there to provide the hospitality that we're known for in the restaurant industry. But with that kind of wage rate, it's really difficult to manage and still be able to make a dollar. Average White Castle makes about 1.5% profit on sales. For every dollar in sales, we're getting to keep about a penny and a half. So when you crank up these rates that high, that doesn't turn into be a small profit. It turns out to be a big loss. So that's why it's concerning to us.
Indeed. And one of the questions I always had is, if you jack up that minimum wage to $15 and you were paying some people $12 an hour and $14 and moving them up that wage ladder, what do you do then? What do you do when now the minimum is $15? What do you say to the people you'd already given raises to that are at $12 or $13? What happens to everything, Jamie?
Lee, that's a great question, and that's the reality that doesn't get discussed a lot in the bumper sticker debate that tends to unfold around these issues. So in reality, let's say you have someone who's a star. They've been with us 6 years. They love what they're doing at White Castle. Maybe they're at $14 an hour. Are you really going to be able to say that individual that now we're bringing in new people who've never worked a day here, and they're going to start at $15, and you're going to be at $15 also? No, you're going to want to keep that proportional. So that's why when we see these things come through, it's across the board in terms of its impact. It's not just for that starting pay position. You don't take someone who's a star and you know, say, oh, we're going to take you back down to the entry level. You want to reward them and treat them with the dignity they deserve for the great job they're doing. So that's part of the difficulty and the challenge. I think in years past, maybe there's been a debate about minimum wage, but candidly, whatever has happened legislatively has been pretty close to where the market is already. This is really jumping the shark in terms of cranking it up beyond any kind of connection to economics. The thing that bothers us the most isn't that we make less money. The thing that bothers us the most is it's harder for us to hire people, especially younger people who are looking for that first job. We're going to have a whole lost generation of kids who never have the opportunity to get that first job and learn skills they can take with them the rest of their life.
You bet. And we do a great segment called First Jobs Fridays, where we talk to everybody, you name it, from famous people. We hear from Ashton Kutcher to ordinary folks about the importance of that first job, what folks learned. And for many people, that first job, that entry-level job, ends up being a profession. You know, Jamie, 450 of your top employees, of the 450 of the top employees at White Castle, again, a privately family-owned business, 444 started out behind the counter in an hourly job. That's astounding, Jamie.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I think being able to be part of a family-owned business just really illustrates that there's room to grow, and there's places to go, and, you know, that's true of restaurants everywhere, and we're especially proud of our White Castle team members who've decided, we're fortunate, they've decided to make this their calling, and, you know, we love those six who didn't start behind the counter at White Castle. They're great folks, too, so,
yep.
But, you know, we really got a great track record and tremendous loyalty, and we think that's because we're treating people right, hopefully, and doing the right thing for the long haul.
You know, even the government admits, and this is the CBO, and we're never going to use terms like CBO much here on this show, folks, so don't have your eyes roll over, but it's just the Congressional Budget Office. And when they were putting together the projections for minimum wage, they said that this would cost at least 500,000 jobs. So you always have to ask yourself the question, Jamie, no job versus a slightly lower minimum wage than everybody would necessarily aspire to. Talk about kiosks, because I keep seeing them popping up in the very strangest of places. Restaurants, Jamie, and I'm seeing them at supermarkets too. Self-checkout, self-service. Talk about that.
Well, certainly one of the pressures that is there is a pressure to quicken the pace of technology and access to technology. You know, keep in mind, we're in the hospitality business when it comes to restaurants. It's also true for retailers. So when you heighten that pressure, you're going to see people make those moves quicker. You know, we're pro-technology at White Castle because we know that that's good for our customers. What we don't want to do is be forced to be in a position where we're not able to staff a restaurant, have those jobs, have those employees there on the front lines who are able to greet a customer, who are able to work the different challenges of working the drive-through. So for us, we're in a people business, and it's always been forward-facing. It's always been about problem-solving, listening, and being responsive. And so, you know, what I think we're going to see, generally speaking, as a move towards more technology. We don't see that as a bad thing, and we don't threaten that as like, oh, we're going to replace jobs with technology. But the fact of the matter is, when you disrupt the marketplace like these by fiat mandatory starting pay measures happen, it really does disrupt the normal course of development, and it makes it tougher for people. Do you know the youth unemployment rate in the state of New York is 21%? That's catastrophic, and it's going to get worse because, candidly, with a forced higher starting pay, those young people aren't going to get the chance for that first job, and that's a shame.
It is. And Jahangir, you got 30 seconds. Just, you know, again, you're talking to policymakers and legislators. Tell them what you think of this, and just let's hear from you as we close things out.
Well, thank you so much for that. I think it's good to have a healthy conversation about the issue. But what I ought to request the policymaker is that the restaurant industry has to have a seat on the table. And every voice has to be heard on that issue before they make a decision.
Guys, I so appreciate it. Jamie Richardson, Vice President of White Castle and a member of Job Creators Network, and Jahangir Kabir, a district supervisor at White Castle. We're done with the serious stuff. And now to that burger, Jamie. How do we take that White Castle burger for people who've never experienced the restaurant and are going into the supermarket? What's the trick? What's the tip? 1 minute, Jamie.
Well, you got tough decisions, cheeseburger or hamburger. Once you've made that choice, I get that 6-pack or 16-pack home. And what I would recommend is put a 2-pack in the refrigerator, let it thaw a little bit, and then when you pop it in the microwave, open just one end of the package, hit 30 seconds on your microwave, and when it is done, it will be the closest to drive-through bliss you can encounter. If you're a purist, you might want to add a pickle. We don't put a pickle on the ones that we put in the microwave because we don't want it to overheat. But you're going to have an incredible experience that is as close to the drive-thru as you could ever imagine. And you'll be craving on in a free world, my friend.
Well, Jamie, thanks so much for that. That is the answer. That is the answer. I've toyed. I've messed. By the way, I can't replace the pickle. You guys have that thin, sliced, perfect pickle. And there's no such thing in the private sector that replaces it. But, folks, you just heard it. Great public policy discussion. And even more important, an important food discussion. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every once in a while, we take a deep dive into a book, and we've been following Foolproof, why safety can be dangerous and how danger makes us safe, because we like to talk about risk here on this show. It's important. We talk about it in a variety of ways that we mitigate risk in our lives and take risk in our lives. And joining us is the author of that book, Greg Ipp, who also happens to be the Wall Street Journal's chief economics commentator. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Lee.
We're on to chapter 10, and the title is, If You Think You Are Dangerous, You Are Safe. Why Airplanes Hardly Ever Crash. Hey, Greg, what a paradoxical thing to actually say, especially to roughly one-third of adults who are actually terrified of flying, including, by the way, my wife, who I have to get liquored up to even get her on a plane. And I don't care if it's 7 a.m.
That's really something, but it's not such an unusual story. Yeah, and I think we've talked on your show, Lee, about how some of the things that we think make us safe actually put us in danger because it changes our behavior and we're a little bit more relaxed about risk. Well, today I want to talk to you about the opposite, about how when we are really afraid of something, it can paradoxically make us safer. And I think aviation is the perfect example of that. You know, it's not just your wife. There's a lot of people out there who find the thought of flying kind of scary, and who wouldn't? You climb onto this aluminum tube. They throw you through the stratosphere at a, you know, where the temperature is 70 degrees below zero. You're flaring over the polar ice cap. This machine has a million moving parts, any of which could go wrong and bring the airplane down. Well, who wouldn't be scared? But, you know, the amazing thing is that we do this thousands of times per day. And aviation is one of the safest ways to travel, if not the safest. And the paradox is that it's precisely because people are so worried about the possibility of a plane crash that everybody, the passengers, the air traffic controllers, the regulators, the airlines, and the manufacturers just work overtime to make it as safe as possible. And that is why aviation is so safe, because people are so intolerant of the types of risks that can arise when they're flying.
I also think part of it might be that there's no control, too, Greg. I mean, my wife's in a car. She feels fine. Meanwhile, I'm in a car, and I'm thinking, wow, some teenager texting somebody's about to ram into me head on. I'm mortified when I'm driving down a country two-lane road. I am always thinking it's that I'm one turn or one wisp away from an untimely death. Well, let's face it. We got two airline pilots who are also highly trained as well, commandeering that plane, and the odds of them both texting and being liquored up at the same time is probably pretty low.
Well, that's true. And it's also true that the lack of control is one reason why people are afraid to fly, but they're not afraid to drive. But the important thing is to keep in mind all is that it's not just the pilots themselves and the controllers, they take on board the fact that this is a high-risk enterprise. And they themselves sort of adopt a mentality that they call being a little bit scared all the time. So you mentioned, well, do pilots text? Well, I have a little story in my book about how there was a pilot who was showing his iPad to his co-pilot when he realized they were on the airport tarmac. They had rolled past a place they were supposed to stop and await instructions to take off. And he, until the air traffic controller was yelling in his ear, stop, stop, stop. And he felt really bad about it. And he actually reported the fact that he had made this mistake to this anonymous reporting agency run by NASA. And this agency then took that story and they published it and they spread it to everybody. Now, why would they do that? Why would a pilot admit to doing something so stupid why would he report that to somebody who would then publicize it to everybody? Precisely the fact that everybody else in the industry reads these stories, that they're always aware that they could make that mistake themselves, and they take extra care. So again, that is something in aviation they call it blameless incident reporting.
Yep.
And the fact that people are encouraged to step forward and admit the mistakes they've made so that other people can learn from them is one of the things that makes aviation so safe.
Boy, blameless incident reporting should be in every family and every company, shouldn't it, Greg?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, can you imagine bankers doing that, stepping forward and saying, yeah, we had this rogue trader who exceeded his risk management. I want everybody else to know about this. No, I mean, first of all, there's a lot of this competitive pressure. They don't want their competitors to know the mistakes they've made, but they also don't want to get sued or they don't want to get in trouble from the regulators.
Right.
But there's another difference here, which is that, hard to believe as it is, we accept in a lot of walks of life that failure is okay. We accept that some banks, small ones, we hope, are going to fail. But in aviation, we don't really accept that attitude. We don't really want to accept the fact that any airplane can be allowed to crash.
Right.
And so we go overboard on that. So do you remember back a few years ago, there was this volcano in Iceland that blew its top and it spread all this ash into the upper atmosphere?
Oh, yeah, and all the flights were grounded?
Yeah, all the flights were grounded. And the reason they were grounded was because there had been several incidents over the prior decades of airplanes flying through an ash cloud and their engines conking out. And that they, thankfully, nobody ever was hurt or killed in one of those incidents. But the industry basically took the attitude, and the regulators took the attitude, we just don't know how what the right concentration of ash is to allow an airplane to fly. And so when that volcano blew its top, they shut down all the air traffic across the North Atlantic. And if you know anybody who was stuck in another country when that happened, you know how frustrating it was. And it was economically very costly. I mean, there were like flower growers in Kenya who went out of business because they couldn't get their fresh flowers to Europe. And it cost like $4 or $5 billion. But this is the price that we're willing to pay because we are so unwilling to accept any possibility of a plane crash.
Yeah, I mean, United Airlines doesn't want to have as its moniker in advertising for the year, we only lost a couple this year. That's just not going to, it's not a winning marketing philosophy. Hey, tell
absolutely.
Us. Tell
absolutely.
Us about. Tell
you know,
us
telling somebody they get on, you know, you only have a 1 in 1,000 or 1 million chance of dying on this flight is absolutely not going to encourage people to, like, relax.
Yeah, it's not a winner. Tell us about this fascinating character, Greg, that you write about in the chapter named Arnold Barnett. His story. Why was he in there?
Arnie Barnett is what you call an applied probabilist. He actually studies statistics and probability, and he's probably the world's leading expert on aviation safety. And like your wife, Arnie Barnett didn't want to fly. He had a fear of flying. And so he started studying this issue to find out just how safe it was. And he was suspicious of some of the claims the airlines had put out there. And he found that it really is pretty safe to fly. And now when he gets on airplanes, he actually talks to people who are afraid to fly. And he says, look, here are some statistics for you. An American is 1,000 times more likely to die in his life in an auto accident as in a plane crash. If you fly to another city for hospital treatment, you're 20,000 times more likely to die because of a mistake in the hospital than you are on the airplane. And here's my favorite one. Because it's so much safer over the long haul to fly than to drive, then when you fly from, say, Boston or New York to Chicago, you're not just saving time. You're more likely to arrive alive. And so his statistic is that if you fly from Boston to Chicago, you will gain not just 12 hours of time by flying instead of driving, but you will add 15 minutes to your life expectancy.
That's great.
So these are nice kind of little ways that he found to explain to people just how safe it is to fly.
Yep, it's so true. Hey, you know, you write that flying wasn't always this safe. We did an hour on the Wright brothers, and we learned from David McCulloch that both brothers never flew in their, as I call it, their test aircraft together. Because the probability of something bad happening was, well, it was high. In fact, Orville got in a terrible wreck and almost died. This wasn't always a safe endeavor.
No, in fact, there's a good reason why people from an early day were suspicious of flying. It's because it actually was really dangerous. I mean, the probability of a pilot dying in the first 3 years was astonishingly high. And in fact, the first in the 1920s, when aviation first began to spread, the way most people heard about it is that these barnstormers who were often flying old World War I aircraft would go around the country doing stunts, and they would routinely die. The plane would crash. So it's no wonder that people thought it was scary. And the people in the commercial aviation industry who were trying to get people, trying to actually start the nascent passenger airline business, said, you know, this is terrible. The only thing that people think about when they think about airplanes is incompetent pilots crashing their airplanes and killing everybody. And so they actually begged for federal regulation. And Herbert Hoover, who was the Commerce Secretary at the time, said this is the first time in history that any industry has begged to be regulated, because they wanted that basically seal of approval to reassure people that it was safe to fly.
Well, that's great storytelling. Greg Gipp, thanks for joining us. The book is Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. This is Our American Stories, and I'm Lee Habib, and you're listening to the Blue Stingrays, a late 1990s rock band that played surf rock, incorporating some country and western elements with an overall Hawaiian atmosphere. The band was composed of the members of the Heartbreakers, Tom Petty's extraordinary backup band, who took a short break from their work with Petty to record one album, Surf and Burn. Today we bring you the story of a surf guitar legend on this day in history, brought to you, as always, by Hillsdale College. You know his music and you know his sound, but you might not know the origin of the iconic and immediately recognizable tone of one of the most famous guitar players in America. Here's Our American Stories executive producer, Jesse Edwards.
Dick Dale, born May 4th, 1937, is an American rock surf guitarist known as the King of the Surf Guitar.
Oh, how he can rock those strings. Oh, how he makes you sing. Listen to the King.
He pioneered the surf music style, drawing on Eastern musical scales and experimenting with reverberation. He worked closely with Fender to produce custom-made guitar amps, including the first ever 100-watt guitar amp. He pushed the limits of electric amplification technology, helping to develop new equipment that was capable of producing distorted yet thick and clearly defined tones at previously undreamed-of volumes. Neck speed of his single-note staccato picking technique and showmanship with the guitar is considered a precursor to heavy metal music, influencing guitarists from Jimi Hendrix to Eddie Van Halen. Born in Massachusetts, Dick Dale is of Lebanese descent from his father and Polish from his mother. They farmed in Whitman, Massachusetts. He learned to play music, starting with the piano, when he was 9 years old. Dale admired Hank Williams and wanted to become a cowboy singer, so he bought a plastic ukulele for $6 and taught himself to play by reading an instruction book. The first song Dick Dale played on the ukulele was the Tennessee Waltz. He then learned to play guitar using a combination of style incorporating both lead and rhythm aspects so that the guitar filled the place of the drums. In 1954, his father got a job in the Southern California aerospace industry. His parents drove the family across the country to live in El Segundo, California, where Dale graduated from Washington Senior High School. It was in Southern California that he learned to surf at the age of 17. He soon learned to play the drums and the trumpet. Due to his Lebanese heritage, he also found strong interest in Arabic music, which later played a major role in his development of surf rock music. Dale was a surfer and wanted his music to reflect the sounds he heard in his mind while surfing. He was among the first guitarists to use reverb, which gave the guitar a sound that has become a staple of surf music. Being left-handed, he initially had to play a right-handed guitar, but then changed to a left-handed model. He did this without restringing the guitar, leading him to effectively play the guitar upside down, often playing reaching over the fretboard rather than wrapping his fingers up from underneath. Dale is also noted for playing his percussive, heavy bending style, using what most guitarists consider very heavy gauge strings, 16s to be exact. Guitar string manufacturers do not make string sets for standard tune electric guitars heavier than 13s. His desire to create a certain sound led him to push the limits of his equipment. The famous Leo Fender of Fender Guitars kept giving Dale amps, and Dale kept blowing them up. Until one night, Leo went down to the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, California, and stood in the middle of 4,000 screaming and dancing Dick Dale fans. That encouraged Leo Fender to go to the James B. Lansing Loudspeaker Company and explain that he wanted a 15-inch loudspeaker built to his specifications. It made the complete package for Dale to play through and was named the Single Showman Amp. When Dale plugged in his Fender Stratocaster guitar into the new Showman Amp and loudspeaker cabinet, Dale became the first person on Earth to jump from the volume scale of a modest, quiet guitar player on a scale of 4 to blasting through the volume scale to 10. That is when Dale became the father of heavy metal, as quoted from Guitar Player magazine. Dale broke through the electronic barrier limitations of that era. During a six-month period that began July 1st, 1961, Dick Dale's performances at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa are credited with the creation of the surf music phenomenon. Dale asked for and gained permission to use the 3,000-person capacity ballroom for surfer dances after overcrowding at a local ice cream parlor where he performed made him seek other venues. The Rendezvous ownership and the city of Newport Beach agreed to Dale's request on the condition that he prohibit alcohol sales and implement a dress code. Dale's events at the ballroom, called Stomps, quickly became legendary, and the events routinely sold out. Let's Go Trippin' is often regarded as the first surf rock song. It was followed by more locally released songs, including Jungle Fever and Surf Beat on his Deltone label. Dick Dale's first full-length album was Surfer's Choice in 1962. The album was picked up by Capitol Records and distributed nationally. Dale soon began appearing on The Ed Sullivan Show and in films where he played his signature single, Miser Lou. People of my age probably know Miser Lou best from the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. But what a lot of people don't know is that it's a traditional song from the Eastern Mediterranean region. The earliest recordings of the song are a 1919 Egyptian composition called Bent Miser and a 1927 Greek composition influenced by Middle Eastern music. There are also traditional Jewish, Armenian, and Turkish versions of the song. The song gained worldwide popularity through Dick Dale's 1962 American surf rock version, which popularized the song in Western pop culture. His second album was named after his performing nickname, King of the Surf Guitar. Though he continued performing live, Dale was soon set back by cancer. Though he recovered, he retired from music for several years. He recorded a new album in 1986 and was nominated for a Grammy. In 1987, he appeared in the movie Back to the Beach, playing surf music and performing Pipeline with Stevie Ray Vaughan. In 2009, he was inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee. Being such a unique and versatile artist, Dick Dale is not limited to his musical skills. He proved to be a respected home designer and builder, personally designing and building his parents' 7,000-square-foot single-story dream home in California. Dick Dale is also an accomplished horseman, exotic animal trainer, surfer, martial arts expert, archer, and pilot. In closing, we hear from Dick Dale on his music philosophy, playing style, and how he relates to an audience.
People say to me, how come there's so many different types of people coming to your concerts? It's because I play to the grassroots people. I do not play to musicians. Musicians count on the one and. And people count on the one. So by me playing on the one, I'm truly playing to the people when they clap. People will clap on a one. Example, if the musician says, everybody follow us, they'll go like this. Well, the games people play now, every night and every day now. If you notice, it's the offbeat. Once that musician stops and the audience is still clapping, here's what happens to the audience. They're going to start like this. Well, the games people play now, every night and every day now. And all of a sudden, when the musician starts clapping, the audience is going to go like this. Well, the games people play now, every night and every day now. See, they were on the unbeat. So when I play, all of my solos, all of my rhythms are all done on da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that's why they can feel what I do. So when you learn music, learn grassroots music, right, through the people that you're playing. Music makes you forget all your problems. It's a soothing factor. And it forgets who you are. It's your best friend. It's almost like the bartender who talks to the man who's drinking. Music will soothe you.
How about that? An American original, a legendary American guitarist born from immigrant parents who single-handedly created the surf guitar sound with influences ranging from Arabic to country music that would ultimately go on to influence the future of another genre and an entirely different one, heavy metal. Dick Dale, born this day in history, brought to you as always by Hillsdale College. Visit Hillsdale online at hillsdale.edu. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's time for our On Leadership series, where we talk with leaders of all stripes about what shaped them as a leader, what they've learned as a leader, and what they're leading today. Earlier today, we were honored to be joined by Ed Renzi, the former head of McDonald's and Famous Dave's, and now we bring you highlights from our conversation. We always start these conversations on leadership with your first job as a kid. What did you learn from it, and what was that job?
Well, when I was about 11 years old, I grew up in Hopedale, Ohio, which is a small town of about 900 people, and obviously there weren't very many jobs available for anybody. And my next-door neighbor, Ron Theodore, was stocking grocery shelves at Jean Angel's Grocery, and he said he was going to quit and not do that anymore, so he said he'd get me the job. Well, I got the job. I think I made $4 a week. And I worked for Vern Genangelo, and his brother owned a dry goods store right next door, LeMoyne. And I stocked shelves. And, you know, I was 11 years old. What do I know about stocking shelves? And the one thing I learned was it was hard work because there was no air conditioning in summertime. I also shoveled coal in his coal cellar to keep the place warm in the wintertime. And it was as my dad always said, you know, you give them a full day's work for a full day's pay, and you be fair about it, and they'll be fair about it. And I just learned that he wanted me to sock the shelf, sweep the floor, fire the furnace, dust things, move things. And if I didn't like it, I could quit. But I always got paid on time, and there was no air conditioning. So he said, well, go sit in the cooler and have a Verner's ginger ale. And I'd go sit in the meat locker when I got done and drink that 6-ounce bottle of Verner ginger ale. And it was such a delight to know that I'd accomplished something, earned some money, and I was treated with respect and dignity.
And back then, by the way, no one had air conditioning. And so getting into that cooler, what a treat for you.
That's a big deal. That was a big deal. It was even warmer in the wintertime. So, you know, you learn a lot about dealing with adults and responsibility, and Vern treated me well, and, you know, and his wife always treated me well, and they treated me. I was 11 years old, and they were in their late 40s, early 50s, and they treated me with respect. They valued my work.
Yep. And talk about the area you grew up in. You mentioned it, but talk about what the people there did for a living, what the circumstances were like. Was it a middle-class town, working town, minor town? Describe the people, the nature, and the character of your town, and what drove that town.
Well, the anchor point of the community was the school, because everybody came together to school. Everybody's kids were in school, and school was very, very highly valued. Because a lot of the people there never graduated from grade school, let alone high school. My dad made it through the eighth grade. My mother graduated. In fact, my mother's high school French teacher was my high school French teacher many, many years later. But they had tremendous values. A lot of churches in town. Everybody went to church on Sunday. Didn't make any difference which religion because everybody had the same amount of faith. But it was a little bit of agriculture, very rocky, hilly Appalachian. But the coal mines and the steel mills were everything. If you were a United Mine worker, if you were, my dad was a Teamster. He drove coal trucks. He worked security in the mines and ultimately became a deputy county sheriff. All my uncles and my grandfathers, they all worked in the coal industry. So coal and steel were it. They were really good paying middle class jobs. The houses were well kept. The cars were well kept. Kids were dressed well. There wasn't a hell of a lot of poverty in that area. And then Look Magazine published an article. I don't remember the exact dates, but it was, early 60s. It said that Steubenville, Ohio was the dirtiest town in America. And then Pittsburgh started to completely rejuvenate the steel mills, the downtown. They spent a ton of money. Mellon put up all kinds of money.
Yep.
The whole Golden Triangle was developed, and they started cleaning up the steel mills. Well, when they started putting pressure on the steel mills started moving, and they started shutting down. Now, there's no steel produced in that area. And the steel industry was driven by access to the Ohio River for ore barges, for scrap metal, and for coal.
Right.
They built a huge hydroelectric plant there, developed enough electricity to do titanium. And titanium, the first titanium was used in aircraft. I think it was first used in the U-2 aircraft, and it was produced at that mill. Well, all those mills have shut down now. All the coal mines are shut down because they started going after the coal mines for their strip pits and knocking off the tops of hills and flooding and water.
Yep.
So now we have a beautiful, pristine countryside, and nobody has any work. The houses are deteriorated. These were hardworking people that just wanted to have a chance to succeed, send their kids to college. Because the byword in my town was, make sure that your kids had a better life than you had. And it was, I can remember my dad, I didn't know what the hell college was. My dad said, well, you're going to go to college. You're going to graduate next year. I said, how do I do that? He says, well, I don't know. He said, ask one of your teachers. So I went to George Ball, who was my chemistry teacher, a wonderful guy. And he said, well, if you're going to go to college, he said, you got to get better grades. These C's and D's ain't going to make it. And I hated school. No. I hated every minute of school. He said, these C's and D's aren't going to make it. This was my junior year. So, man, I went to work, and I graduated my senior year. I had straight A's my senior year in every class, and I ended up getting a very small academic scholarship. I think I got $700 or $800. I tell people all the time I graduated seventh in my class out of 17 kids. I usually stop at seven.
That's smart.
Than a 17th part.
That's funny.
But, the good, solid, hardworking people that were dedicated to having their kids become more successful than they were. And it was an inclusive community. They took care of everybody. There was no discrimination in the coal mines. It was, it was the brotherhood of darkness.
You bet.
It made no difference who you were. You worked your ass off.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. More with our Armed Leadership Series and Ed Renzi, the former head of McDonald's, and Famous Dave's after these short messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And each week, we like to dig into leadership as a subject. not enough is talked about on this subject, and we learn too little until it's too late often. And so we want to dig in with real life leaders who've led major companies, led sports teams, and that's why we're continuing our conversation right here with the former head of McDonald's, Ed Renzi. Let's pick up the conversation where we left off.
My grandparents, during World War II, my grandmother ran an overhead crane in a steel mill. And my mother worked the entire time that World War II was going on. And these women worked hard. My mother worked every day that I was, from the time I was born, she worked. And she worked all the way. In fact, my mother quit running her restaurant when she was 83 years old. And she died when she was 86. Those folks did not know how not to work. We never took a vacation.
Right.
Who the hell took a vacation?
So, Ed, it's so true. And it's so hard to explain to young people today who assume that they should be getting spring breaks and skiing vacations and snorkeling vacations. And I told them I had one vacation when I was a kid. It was a trip to Niagara Falls, six kids in a Buick Electra 225 that was 9 years old. That was it. We worked. We all had jobs. We put money towards the family. And I got to tell you, I think kids are happier when they're working, Ed. I think that they're not distracted. They don't get caught up with stupidity. They don't have time. They're too busy. Talk about that before we dig into more of your life.
I'm not going to judge how anybody raises their children, but something has been lost. And I don't know where it happened. Something has been lost when we no longer value work production, when we no longer value leadership and teamwork and working together. If you look at the unemployment rate in teenage black America, particularly young men, my God, it's 60-70%.
Yep.
These young black men have tremendous talent, tremendous capabilities, and they're just being squandered. I mean, Hispanics, You'll never meet a culture in the world like Mexicans and their willingness to work hard. My God, they're some of the hardest working people I've ever met in my life. I've been in the food industry all my life. And I look at what goes on in the agricultural industry and how hard they work. And we ought to be celebrating that. I'm a guy that believes we ought to open up the Mexican border and treat it like Canada. If you want to come here to work, God bless. Come.
Yep.
They want to go back to Mexico. I know. I love Mexico. I love Mexico City. I love, Monterrey, Mexico. I think Mexico is a beautiful country with wonderful people. A lot of Mexicans are European immigrants.
That's right.
You know, there's a lot of Italians in Mexico. People don't realize Mexico welcomed lots of people during the Great Migrations from Europe. And we don't value their hard work. We should be celebrating those people. We should be embracing those people. We should make it easy for them to come here. They don't want to live here their whole life. They come here for opportunity. They're going to go home. They will go home. They'll go visit their families. The Mexican families are so family-centric. They have beautiful children. Okay, I'm ranting now.
No, but we love getting the passions of folks, and this is a big one for you, Ed, and you've been close, and so many people have formed opinions about a group of people they don't know. They've never met. And this is so true, and I'm so glad that you touched that. And by the way, we were going to ask about your mother and father, Ed, but my goodness, you covered that. The other thing we love to ask leaders in the young formational parts of their lives is, was there a teacher? We love celebrating. We don't like bad teachers, by the way, Ed, but we love good ones. My dad was a superintendent of schools in New Jersey, spent his whole life as an educator, as a coach, and we love celebrating great teachers. Was there a teacher in your life that said, Ed, you can do more with your life? Ed, you need to work harder.
It's interesting you ask that question because my goal in life was to go to school, and I could only go to Ohio State because the only place I could afford. And I could get in that school with bad grades because under Ohio law at that time, if you had a C average, they had to take you to Ohio State. So I went into that school in the summer session because that was the only way they had let me in. I was scared to death I was going to flunk out after 8 weeks. And I studied my butt off. And I ended up with a 2.8 that summer. And I thought, my God, I'm a C-plus student. That's great. Because I've always been a D-plus student. At any rate, my goal was to teach chemistry, biology, and physical sciences and go back to my hometown school and teach. And the reason was the school teachers of my school were Bull Renzi, a cousin of mine, Warren Renzi, he was a cousin of mine, Leonard Costantini, who was a next-door neighbor, Danny Carrier, who was a history teacher, and his wife, who was a social studies teacher. They were all from our hometown, and they all came back to teach. And they all ended up with PhDs. And Leonard Costantini, who was a Korean War veteran, who I, as a youngster, watched arrive home from Korea. I was up in a cherry tree. I'll never forget this. When they pulled up and he got out of the car in his uniform, my uncle came home from the Air Force. These guys were all returning from Korea. And they were like the heroes of the world. Who'd give a damn about Superman, you know? And these guys ended up being my school teachers. And Leonard Costantini was my physics teacher. He kicked my ass every day.
Yep.
And it was bad enough that he was in the classroom, but I went home at night, and he was coming home with me, and he lectured me all the way up the driveway until he went into his mother and dad's house.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, and they all knew my dad. My dad told me in the first grade, he said, Eddie, you go to school. You do what the teachers tell you because they're always right. And if you ever get paddled, when you come home, you're getting it twice.
That's
and
a great rule.
Honest to God, this is no joke. I didn't like school. I was bored to death with it. So I'm in the first grade, and I got to do the alphabet. And they had these lined papers, and we were printing. And I had to print a line of A's, a line of B's, all the way. I'll never forget this. I got to the bottom, and I had a line of Z's done. But I had about three lines left at the bottom because I printed really small. So I very carefully tore the bottom three lines off the paper, wadded it all up, and put it in my fingers. And I gave it to Mrs. Starr. And she said, Edward, did you cut off the bottom of the page? Now, this is a technicality. I said, no, I didn't cut it off, which I didn't. I tore it off.
Right.
And she said, it looks to me like you cut this off. I said, no, I did not. And she said, well, I don't believe you. You go stand in the corner. So I go stand in the corner, and I got this piece of paper all balled up in my hand, and I very carefully pulled it up in front of my waist, stuck it in my mouth, and I was going to swallow it so she couldn't find it. She saw me do that, and she paddled me three times. Bam, bam, bam. Before I got home, my dad was a town cop at the time. He picked me up at school. He said, I understand you got paddled today. I hadn't even gotten out of the school yet. I got home. I got the belt. I learned right then. Teachers are always right. Even if they're wrong, they're right.
Oh, that's great. And great. By the way,
But those teachers were so dedicated to helping us like their parents helped them.
Yep.
When you have Italian parents, Leonard Costantini's dad, Guy Costantini, could barely speak English. And Leonard went on, got a PhD, and became the dean of academics at Syracuse University. He recently died of cancer. But Leonard was a hero all my life, a war veteran, a war hero. An academic, just a wonderful, wonderful guy. He got his master's and his PhD at Ohio State. And while I was going to school there, he mentored me the entire time I was in school.
This is Lee Habib, and we're going to learn more about Ed and more about leadership in this continuing leadership series here on Our American Stories. And as always, go to ouramericannetwork.org to learn more. Martin Luther King, a terrific piece there on leadership. And John Wooden, if you get a chance, go to ouramericannetwork.org and check out what we did with John Wooden. What a life, what a leader. Again, this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
It's a sense of what you need to say. Sometimes I write a little song so you don't forget it. Sometimes I write a little song to remember the lyrics. I go 8, 12. That's a code to my heart. I go 1, 6, 1, 2. Star Aquarian, 4 Taurus. I strike on the box. Frank Sinatra. 16, 12.
This is Our American Stories, and we're back with our On Leadership series, this week with Ed Renzi, the former head of McDonald's and Famous Dave's. Let's continue this conversation with an American classic. I wanted to talk about Ohio State. You go to Ohio State, and then you proceed to drop out. You got to tell us this story, Ed.
Well, I found myself in a situation where I was going to have a baby, and I had to work. And, you know, I was managing an apartment building, checking people in and out, because it was basically a college apartment building, and it had 20 units in it. I was cutting the grass, doing maintenance, going to school, taking care of that place, living with my wife. And I had to have $85 a week to live. And, man, I went to school, and Leonard Costantini told me, he said, Ed, you got a choice. He said, you either drop out of school and get your stuff together, or you're going to flunk out of this place. And if you flunk out of here, you're not getting in anywhere else. Because I had a very low B average at the time. And I love science, but I thought, well, heck. So I went in and saw my college counselor, and I said, I got to drop out of school. And that was in February of 66. And I was going to graduate in 67. And I walked out of the Arps Hall, I'll never forget this, walked down this one flight of steps, and I was crying all the way down those steps because I had to call my mom and dad up, who had sacrificed so much for me, and say, folks, they didn't know I was married and didn't know I had a kid coming.
Oof.
I never told, we never told anybody. And Leonard knew what was up because I told him everything. He was like the priest.
Yep.
And so I went across the street, and there's a big sign in this window said, Help One, and I walked in and met a guy by the name of Ed Brown. I said, Mr. Brown, my name's Ed Renzi, and I need a job, and I got to make $85 a week because that's my living expense. He said, well, that won't be any problem. We pay 85 cents an hour, and you can work 100 hours a week. I said, hell, I've done that all my life. That's not a problem.
Done
and
deal.
Literally, I went to work for McDonald's the first month I was there, February. I worked 100 hours a week. I didn't have a car. I walked home every day. Still managed that apartment building. I'll tell you, you talk about tired.
Yep, yep. And by the
but
way,
the good news was I got a free lunch and a dinner. So the grocery bill was taken care of.
And you had no time to spend any money or get in trouble, Ed. I mean, face it. You were either working or sleeping, basically.
Well, when we finally told our parents what was going on, my dad gave me a 1957 Chevrolet that was just a pig. And that made it a little bit easier. And then they put a sign up, said, managers wanted. And I signed up. I said, I'd like to be a manager. How much do they pay? And they said, they pay $95 a week. I said, shit, I got a $10 raise coming. And I only have to work 70 hours a week.
Oh, my goodness.
So I signed up as a manager trainee. I started February the 2nd, 1966, and left there in 1999.
Ed, this is an amazing journey because you leave school, you drop out of Ohio State, you got a newly pregnant wife, a soon-to-be-born child, you start at 85 cents an hour, and as incredible as this may sound, but it's not made up. You made it all the way to the president and CEO of McDonald's for making 85 cents an hour. Talk about that, Ed.
Well, the reality of it is, just to back up just a little bit, I ultimately did get my degree. I went back to school and finally got a degree and graduated in January of 1990.
Right.
I had a Bachelor of Business degree. And Dr. James Buffer, who was my counselor at Ohio State Department of Education, he's critically ill right now. I just got word from his daughter that Dr. Jim is having some problems, so I got to get a hold of him. But, you know, McDonald's was 10 years old when I got there, basically, and Fred Turner and Ray Kroc. Ray Kroc had a vision. He was a salesman, and he had a vision to sell milkshake machines that got turned into selling hamburgers, and he hired Fred Turner, the absolute genius of McDonald's.
Yep.
Fred Turner was one of the most brilliant leaders that has ever lived. This guy could read people. He hired great people. He was intuitive. He was strategic as hell. He understood the marketplace, and he had absolutely uncompromising standards. And young guys like me, young gals, he would say, okay, here's an opportunity. You can either get it right and succeed or screw off and leave. We're not putting up with it. And one thing I learned in that whole process was, if you want a job, stay where you're at. If you want a career, you better move, because opportunities pop up all over the place. And if you get your boss promoted, there's always a leadership vacuum behind that boss that somebody's got to fill, and it might as well be you. So when they said to me, we want you to go to Sharon, Pennsylvania, I went. When they said, we want you to go to Jamestown, New York, I went. When they said, we want you to go to Washington, D.C., I went. When they said, we want you to go to Raleigh, I said, I'll go. When they said, no, we changed our mind, you're going to Philadelphia. So I went to Philadelphia. I lived on the East Coast for the first third of my career. They then said, we want you to go to Chicago. I did not want to go to Chicago. I love Philadelphia. Great people there. Great. I love the East Coast. I would live in Manhattan tomorrow if I could afford it. And I love New Jersey, and I love Philadelphia. The best produce I've ever eaten in my life and seafood was in Philadelphia. So then I moved to Chicago, and that's now my second home, and I've lived there since 1978. All along the way, I was in school. McDonald's required us to go to leadership training in school. 90% of it was in-house. Some of it was out. I took courses for finance, for non-financial executives. I did real estate. Because Fred Turner believed if you don't educate your workforce, they will fail ultimately. They need to be able to think on their own. And this was an adage I developed, and it comes really out of the Franciscans. You know, ask for forgiveness, not permission.
Yep.
If you do it for the right reasons, then the result is that's how I helped start the Ronald McDonald House. Hell, nobody at McDonald's has ever done anything like that before, but it just seemed like such a brilliant idea, and I said, yes, let's do this thing. And I said, we'll use the money from the Shamrock milkshakes to fund this thing, but you got to call it the Ronald McDonald House. I never called anybody and said, hey, what do you think about this? Should we do it? Well, there's no big, long strategic plan. There was no discussion. It was, this feels good. It's the right idea. Trust each other, and if the thing turns into more, say, okay, I made a mistake, let's move on. And that's one of the lessons I learned as an executive. Plan B is beautiful.
Yep.
I don't care how hard you work on plan A. If it's not working, admit the mistake and get to the next thing.
Exactly.
Sitting around feeling sorry for yourself that you screwed up does you no good. And that's one of the things I notice about great athletes, great football players, Tom Brady, I don't give a damn who they are. You know, these great athletes, when they fail, they just assume that that was a blip on the radar.
Yep.
They know that when they go out there, I saw a movie one time. Gene Hackman, I think, was in this movie, or one of them really great actors. And it was a football show about a bunch of misfits. And he said that leaders always want the ball at the end of the game to win it. And I absolutely believe that. Leaders are willing to step up and do what is necessary, no matter how many failures there were behind them. And leadership is all about admitting how weak you are, but being willing to take the risk for the greater good.
Folks, that's a leadership lesson you won't hear from the mainstream media. Leadership is all about admitting how weak you are and how we all need each other in our weakness. We've been talking to Ed Renzi for the hour, the former head of McDonald's and Famous Dave's, for our On Leadership series, the final portion of our conversation after these short messages.
Thank you.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're back with our On Leadership series this week with Ed Renzi, and we've covered a lot of territory here, and we're learning a lot always as we do these segments and these hours with these leaders. Some of the common themes we're stumbling upon, my goodness, starting work early. We heard that in the first segment. Well, let's take a listen to how things ended in our conversation earlier today with the former head of McDonald's and Famous Dave's. Let's continue now with the final portion of my conversation with this American classic. Tell me this, Ed. We ask everybody this who's in our leadership segment. What was your worst mistake?
Oh, boy. This is going to stir up a manure pile.
Good.
When the environmentalist, you know, my background was physical sciences.
Yep.
And when we got into the big debate, when that garbage scow was running up and down the East Coast and they were trying to figure out where to dump it, styrofoam became a big issue in landfills because it doesn't biodegrade. And that's great because nothing in a landfill biodegrades. We're creating tombs for garbage. We line them with clay. We line them with plastic. We put pumps in them to get the water out of them. And nothing will biodegrade unless it has oxygen and bacteria and water.
Yep.
Will not degrade. That's why litter along the street, if it's paper, ultimately is going to dissolve and go away. Put it in a landfill. So I had some studies done. I had a professor of archaeology at the University of Arizona, a guy by the name of Bill Rathje, do an archaeological dig on the Schuylkill landfill in New York City and took a 4-foot auger and went down to the 1900s. We were pulling newspapers out of that landfill that you could read. No biodegrading. I actually had him write a book on the science of landfills and archaeological exploration of landfills. So I said, there is no way in hell we're going to quit using styrofoam for Big Mac boxes. And I fought that for probably 6 months, and I got my rear end handed to me. I might have been right from a science standpoint, but the consumer didn't have good facts or good information. And I capitulated and said, this ain't about doing what's right. This is doing what's good for public relations. So we'll fail smartly, declare victory, and go to cardboard boxes. And that's what happened. And to this day, they're still using cardboard boxes on the Big Mac. But the fact of the matter is, I was right from a science standpoint and wrong from a customer standpoint. Now, I'll tell you the reason why I say it's a mistake. Because I wasn't just representing my beliefs. I represented a customer base, and I represented employees. And more importantly, I represented franchisees and their employees. And the franchisees are small business people in 35,000 street corners around the world. Everybody thinks McDonald's is a gigantic billion-dollar business. It's not. McDonald's is a $2 million restaurant on street corners all over the world. And that's one of the big mistakes the executives at McDonald's are making. They're not running a big company. They're running a restaurant. I say the biggest and most strategic thing anybody at McDonald's can do is keep the bathrooms clean.
Yep.
Because that's where McDonald's is belly-to-belly with their customers every day.
You know,
so the biggest mistake I made was not recognizing that I had a number of people I was serving. I was serving not only the customer, but I was also selling my associates within the McDonald's system. And our franchisees were getting their ass handed to them. And I didn't have the right to do that. I needed to do something so they could maintain their sales and profitability.
Yeah, you put your own opinions and your own ideas
feelings
ahead of the constituencies that mattered most to the company. And
yeah, it's the greater good.
Yep,
you've got to think about the greater good.
We love to ask folks their philosophy on hiring and firing. You know, interestingly, I was at University of Virginia Law School. And Hank Paulson was then the head of Goldman
sure.
Sachs. And I just, you know, I have no business being in an interview. I was a law student. He was interviewing MBAs, but he took an occasional law student. I had no desire to work at Goldman Sachs, but it interested me that the chairman of Goldman Sachs was interviewing. So I interviewed him. I showed up at the interview in a pair of shorts, asked him if he'd go to lunch, and I wrote the student newspaper at law school. And it was interesting. He said he spent 25% of his time recruiting, and he thought he would have a competitive advantage at a great school like the Darden School, interviewing himself rather than a VP. But he also told me he spent 25% re-recruiting. That is, he wanted to keep the people happy at Goldman so that he didn't lose them. Does that sound about right to you? You sound like a guy who's very big on recruiting and re-recruiting yourself, Ed.
Well, it's a lot easier to keep quality people than it is to hire new ones. So training and developing and mentoring and listening are really important. McDonald's has probably got the lowest turnover of any corporation in the history of mankind. You know, my statement was, if I hire a dishwasher, I want to see a training and development program that dishwasher will be the CEO of the company in 35 years. And if they can't manage the next level, then they'll sort out. And 65% of it, back in my day, 65% of the hourly employees became managers, and 65% of the managers became supervisors, and 65% of the supervisors became mid-management executives, and 65% of them became the department heads and assistant vice presidents. And everybody in McDonald's up until, you know, one generation of executives ago were all restaurant managers that knew what was going on. I used to say all the time that 3,000 employees at the corporate headquarters are going to do too much work for an assistant manager in North Dakota to be able to cope with. So our goal is to make their life as simple as possible, not to overcomplicate it. And so keeping the ones you've got and training them and nurturing them is the only way to operate a business. That's different in sports because your physical skills go away.
Yep.
But all those great black athletes that have played all major league sports, why aren't they general managers of teams? Why aren't they the coaches of teams? What is the program to take them from being the best damn linebacker on the face of the earth or the best defensive end and getting them to be a coach at a senior level?
Let's talk about minimum wage of $15. And you wrote in Forbes an article that was top trending called The Ugly Truth about a $15 minimum wage. Again, we don't want to do politics, but this cuts to the core of the business model that McDonald's and, by the way, 20% of American companies are franchise-based. Talk about the $15 minimum wage.
Well, it doesn't hit just the fast food industry. It hits every industry. For example, car washes.
Yep.
It hit home care, cleaning services. It hits franchises of all sorts. Franchising is the best small business model in the world. It creates takes people that don't know a damn thing about business and creates great business people out of them. And in all this $15 minimum wages, look at the centers of where it's most noisy. There are politicians on both sides of the aisle buying votes with the $15 minimum wage. These are all smart people. They know full well what the implications are from an economic standpoint. They know exactly what's going on. But it serves their purpose to misrepresent so they can buy votes. Look at what's going on in Virginia with this felons getting the right to vote. Now, I don't know every felon in the United States. Probably some of them ought to be allowed to vote. Some of them should have probably never gone to prison in the first place. I don't know that. But we cannot, for political expediency, do dumb things. And a minimum wage is inflationary in any way, shape, or form. If you look at a typical McDonald's restaurant 30 years ago, and its average volume, which I'm going to guess at that time was probably about $1.2 million, $1.3 million, we had 65 to 70 workers in those restaurants. Today, the typical fast food restaurant, McDonald's, is doing $2.6 million. With less than 50 employees. So over that period, every McDonald's restaurant's reduced their overall working staff by 25 to 30 people on average.
Yep.
Okay, what is the most successful business in most low economic communities in the United States? I'll talk about Chicago, for example. McDonald's restaurants were being built in Chicago in the mid to late 60s. It provided great first-time opportunity. Willie Wilson was an hourly employee and a manager in restaurants in Chicago, come to own nine of those things. Today he's a multimillionaire. He's an African-American guy that can't read or write. And McDonald's provided that opportunity because of a minimum wage job, and he worked his butt off. We're taking those opportunities away from these young people. And where are they going to get entry-level job skills? There's social consequences to not having jobs for young people. And they're generational. You can't fix them after a while. You get to a point where you got such a critical mass, you can't do anything about it anymore. $15 minimum wage. You know what's going to happen? They're going to reduce employees. They're going to go to automation, and they're going to raise prices.
Yep.
Those franchisees will do what they got to do to survive.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you've been listening to the insightful and irrepressible Ed Renzi, the former head of McDonald's and Famous Dave's, a guy who worked his way up from 85 cents an hour at McDonald's to president and CEO. It happens, folks, and it happens so much more often than the media would let you know. And these are the kind of stories we bring you time and again here on Our American Stories. He started a brand new restaurant, chain called Tom and Eddie's, from scratch. The guy will just not stop, as long as he has something to contribute to society. To listen to this and all of our On Leadership series interviews, you can find them on our website at OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org.